2000. This is an interview with the Reverend Wardell Harvey Sr. The interview takes place at his church in Paducah, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Reverend Harvey, would you just give me your full name, please?
Wardell, W-A-R-D-E-L-L-E, Green, G-R-E-E-N, Harvey, H-E-R-V-E-Y, Sr.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Reverend Harvey, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Boonville, Indiana, in June the 12th, 1926.
And that makes you how old today?
73 years old.
73. And you're certainly a young-looking man for 73 years old.
Yes.
I wouldn't have guessed that. So. I'd like to begin a little bit, please, by asking you about your early family, your growing up, who was in your family, what you may know about your ancestors.
My grandfather was William Green. His wife was Mattie Green. Mattie Green was half Cherokee Indian. Her father was a Paul Knox from the Owensboro, Kentucky area.
Paul Knox?
Paul Knox.
K-N-O-X.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And her mother was a black woman. Mm-hmm. Yes. And they gave birth to Inez, I-N-E-Z, Washington. Mm-hmm. So that's what was her last name before she died. But anyway, that was my mother.
Let me stop you. You said she was a black woman, so I'm assuming Paul Knox was
a Cherokee Indian, full-blooded Cherokee Indian. Yes, full-blooded Cherokee Indian. Yes. I had an older sister by the name of Marion, and I had have a younger sister. It lives in Evansville, Indiana. Her name is Willamay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Spell Willamay, please.
W-I-L-L-A-M-A-E.
I'll ask you that occasionally for the person who's transcribing.
Yes. All right. Okay. My mother came from Indiana, where she was born. She was born in Richland, Indiana, and they moved to Boonville, Indiana.
Richland,
Indiana. Uh-huh. My mother married my father, who was Elmer Harvey, in Youngstown, Ohio. And my mother left my father when she was 7 months pregnant with me. My father was mean to her. Mm-hmm. I never saw my father until I was 26 years old, mm-hmm. to even meet him. And my father died when I was 42, and I went to that funeral. I had a half brother and a half sister by that first marriage, Elmer and Emily, mm-hmm. and they're both dead now.
Mm-hmm. When your mother left your father, where did she move to?
She went back to Boonville, Indiana.
Okay.
She went to Boonville, Indiana, where her mother and father, William and Mattie Green, lived, and that's where I was raised.
Okay. Tell me, please, a little bit about your early education.
Mm-hmm. I went to Boonville High School. They never had a black high school in Boonville, Indiana. That's how race relations were there in Boonville. In fact, my mother went to the same high school that I went to.
But it was an integrated high school.
Yes. Okay. It wasn't but one high school there.
Let me back up.
Yes,
you
ma'am.
Went to elementary school.
In Boonville. They had a black elementary school.
Okay.
But after the elementary school, they only had the high school.
And the black elementary school went through what year, what grade?
Eighth grade.
Eighth grade, okay.
Yes. Now, just 10 miles from Boonville, a place by name of Newburgh, Indiana, mm-hmm. The black children there, they bus them to Evansville, Indiana, to Lincoln High School. Mm-hmm. So there's just that much difference in 10 miles of relations, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you estimate for me how big the black population was in the town growing up?
In Boonville, the population was probably about 125 at that time.
125,000
people.
People.
Oh, black
little,
people.
Black
little. People.
Okay.
Black people.
And how big?
5,426. That was the total population of Boonville.
Right. I'm surprised you even had a black elementary school for that few. How many were in your classes when you were in elementary school?
About between 28 and 30.
Okay.
Seems like a waste to have one.
And did they, was that total for all 6 years?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you went to school really with children at different levels of elementary school?
All in one room.
Okay.
All in one big room.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about your teachers? And in particular, what I'm looking at is if you know where they got their training.
Juanita McFarlane was my first teacher. Mm-hmm. And another lady, it's very coincidental, no relation or anything, but a lady by the name of Catherine McFarlane came from Evansville to take her place. Mm-hmm. Because Juanita married and moved to California.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have any idea where they got their training to be teachers there?
I really do not.
Okay.
I really do not.
Okay.
But they were great teachers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you went to Lincoln High School.
No.
No.
Boonville High School.
High School.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Lincoln High School was Evansville. In Evansville.
Right. Okay. And Boonsville High School, how many were there in your graduating class, for example, approximately?
There was probably about 40 or 50, I guess, in my whole class. See, we took different subjects at different rooms, you know, and so on, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how many of you were of color?
Probably 8 or 10.
Okay.
Probably 8 or 10.
Can you think back a little bit about what that experience was like for you going to an integrated school after having been in an all-black school?
After being in the elementary black school, it was no problem because we didn't have problems to mount anything in Boonville at all. Just around the corner, about two blocks from where I lived, was one of the best restaurants in Boonville at that particular time. And our families in this restaurant, anytime they want to, sit any place they want to and eat. And I finally, during the summertime, worked there.
Mm-hmm.
The lady's name was Mary Black. I'll never forget her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did your family make their living growing up, while you were growing up?
My father, I remember as a small child, my father worked for the PWA or either the WPA.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the day that Roosevelt died.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the day that Roosevelt died, and they thought that was they almost considered him a Jesus because the economics had changed, you know, and they did have something to do, you know. My mother did day work.
Mm-hmm.
She worked for a rich family by the name of Roth. They owned a dry goods store in Boonville, Indiana. And my mother worked for them a long time. She took care of the house, the cooking, and everything, and they were very nice to her. She went to Minnesota to a home they had up there in the summertime. They were real wealthy. And she went to Albuquerque, New Mexico with them and stayed there with me. She was just a part of the family.
Did you ever get to visit on any of those?
No, I never did. No, trips? No, I sure didn't. No.
Okay. So what year now did you graduate from high school?
I did not graduate from high school.
Okay, tell me about that.
All right. I worked, and when I was a junior in high school, I helped my mother. I said, did they work? We were a poor family. I helped my mother put my older sister, Marion, through Indiana State Teachers College.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I just never went back. I kept helping the family. We were a poor family. And years later, I started to working at Chrysler Corporation in Evansville as a metal finisher. And also I worked in the spray painting department. And I was called into the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And after being called into the ministry, rather than go back to Boonville, I went to a small college in Evansville that was on the east side of Evansville. It was called the Tri-State Baptist College. This college, the professors, they had some real good teachers that organized this school. They were some that had, shall I say, theological, philosophical differences with Southern Baptists at that time. They were all Caucasians, and they started that school. And so I went there, and so I had to take classes because I didn't go, I finished 11th grade, but I had to take classes to make that up. And then after a while, I started on my regular curriculum, and I had a BTH. That's what I graduated with, Bachelor of Theology. But I had to take these other classes because I did not finish at Boonville High School. Yes. And the most tragic thing was, but I felt so sorry for my mother. And I warned my sister, who I love very much, who taught at the same elementary school I went to for 6 years and died suddenly. She was 29 years old. And it just seemed like the bottom fell out of our lives at that particular time, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happened to her?
One night she took sick about 4 or 5 days after having a complete physical examination to teach elementary school, which all teachers took, you know. And she went to Deaconess Hospital at 11 o'clock one night. And I remember the doctor that worked on her at that time, after all these years, his name was Dr. Cochran. She had a severe or unusual type of diabetes, something where the pancreas collapsed immediately, something like that. She went in a coma. Mm-hmm. And the next morning at 8 o'clock, Marion died. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's tragic.
Yes, it was, really.
Never get over
no.
the loss of a young person like that.
No, my mother liked to lost her mind.
Mm. So, at that point, where were you? Were you at the Baptist College, the Tri-State Baptist College, when your sister died?
No, this was before I went in the ministry.
Before you went in the ministry.
Before I went in the ministry. This was before I went in the ministry. I was married.
Experience,
ma'am.
Do you think that experience of your sister's death helped move you to the ministry in some way?
I don't know. She had a lot of influence on me because she was a very religious person. And the piano that she learned how to play on is sitting over there. Mm. It was moved into my mother's house when my mother was 2 years old. My mother was born in 1897. Mm-hmm. The piano was put in the house, so she was a talented musician and a very religious person. Mm-hmm. Very religious, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you finished with your bachelor in theology?
Yes.
Where did you go then? What happened to you next?
I started pastoring my first church. Mm-hmm. I became a missionary for the Ohio Valley District Baptist Association in Evansville. And there was a church that was vacant. And so they put me over there in this small church. They only had 9 or 10 members, and they put me there. And you want me to... And so anyway, the name of this church was First Ebenezer Baptist Church. It was in Evansville on the corner of Sycamore and Morton Street. Mm-hmm. And I went to there. We had probably about 10 people. Mm-hmm. This was a split off of New Hope Baptist Church. The minister died that was there. He was forced into retirement from New Hope Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And that's why this other church was organized. Out of friction and problems, you know. And so they sent me there. I stayed there for 6 years at that church. And we bought a building, and when I left there, we had 160 members. And I came to Paducah, Kentucky, to the Harrison Street Baptist Church.
And that would have been what year?
1962.
Okay.
And I stayed there till March the 16th, 1986. Mm-hmm. And I left there. Several members came to me. There were problems arose. And several members came to me and said, Reverend, let's go somewhere and organize a church. And I had a minister friend from Indiana that I recommended to Macedonia Baptist Church here at that time. And he finally left Macedonia and went to organize a church called First Liberty Baptist Church. And so we gathered there and had a meeting. We had 89 people that wanted to organize this church. And we organized that church on March the 16th, 1986. And we stayed there 6 months worshiping in that church after their services. And then we left there and went to the community center because we wanted to do some other things that was impossible to do there. We held all of our services at the community center. And then in 6 months, we came here to a small building that was here. It was the former Calvary Baptist Church, a Caucasian church. And
the building was the former Calvary,
yes,
Baptist Church.
Yes, right.
And the name of the church now is?
This church is Greater Love Baptist Church, Greater Love Missionary Baptist Church. And we bought this church for $50,000. By being a new church, it was impossible to borrow money unless you'd been in the organization for at least 3 years, they said. And so anyway, I had real good credit at Citizens Bank, and my wife and I signed the note for the church. In 5 years, we paid the $50,000 off. And then we did all the things that you see here that we're doing now in 14 years. Yes.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
Let me go back to when you came to Kentucky in 1962, came to Paducah,
yes,
specifically, which was a pretty important time in the whole history of the civil,
yes,
rights struggle nationally.
Yes.
What was going on in Paducah at that point? What?
Could we just back up just a minute to Evansville, where,
sure,
I was? All right. In Evansville, I became involved in the political arena and civic work. There was segregation in Evansville at the bus station. The Greyhound bus station was segregated. The swimming pools were segregated. And a man by the name of W.R. Brown, I've got his picture over there. W.R. Brown, who pastors New Hope Baptist Church today, he's probably 86 years old or older probably. And as a young minister, I really learned and got a lot of experience those 6 years that I was in Evansville, which is only 15 miles from my home in Boonville. But when I came here in 62, there was a lot of problems. There was not one restaurant. Public accommodations was terrible. Mm-hmm. Even the municipal housing, all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. And I went to work on that, and in the NAACP branch here, and a man by the name of Curly Brown was the president at that particular time, but they probably only had 10 or 15 active members. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do greater than that, and so I organized a nonpartisan league. And the nonpartisan league, it seemed like everybody just fell for it. And we probably had over 100 members. And the nonpartisan league is the one that probably did most of the integrating and opening doors that were closed here in Paducah.
Tell me where you came up with the name Nonpartisan League. What does that mean?
You're neither Democrat,
okay,
or Republican.
Okay.
Just nonpartisan.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And why did you think it important to establish a new organization?
The NAACP is a great organization across the country, but mm-hmm. here it had just sort of fizzled out, mm-hmm. or was not real effective. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe that we needed something new. Mm-hmm. And W.C. Young, who was older than me and a great civil rights worker, he was one of the nominees he's dead, but he was one of the nominees. He and Curly Brown both were. Mm-hmm. And so he was my vice president. And everybody worked just about at that time, you know, and a lot of things they gave me the authority to do. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be the Lone Ranger, but a lot of things I went out there and I really did, you know.
So you were like the president of the group?
I was the president. Okay. I was the president.
How did you go about recruiting people to the league?
The people just saw the problems uh-huh. that they had here.
But did you go to the churches first?
Yes, we put out announcements and stuff that we're going to organize this group, you know, and everything, you know. And young and old, we just had a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of people. We had most of the black business people here at that particular time, you know. Mm-hmm.
Are there any records left from the Partisan League? Anything like correspondence or flyers or minutes?
I have a book here with a whole lot of stuff in it. Clippings from the newspaper that talks about the Nonpartisan League and the things that was achieved and so on.
Okay.
The theaters was even discriminated. You couldn't even go to a drive-in theater, mm-hmm. not even a drive-in theater, sit in your own car. Mm-hmm. And downtown, the Columbia and Arcadia Theater, which was owned by Mr. Kyler.
How do you spell Kyler?
Jack Kyler. K-I-L-E-R, something like that, yeah. And Mr. Brown had met with Mr. Kyler for several times, and nothing was settled, you know. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I got some copies, some letters in there that I wrote to the mayor, mm-hmm. and to talk to Mr. Kyler, because he was a friend of his, and to make a way for me. And then I had an appointment with Mr. Kyler, and I probably had 2 or 3 sessions with Mr. Kyler, and it just seemed like we clicked for some reason or another. Possibly because of my personality being a little different from Mr. Brown's. I wasn't maybe quite as pushy at that time and so on. And so we solved the problem. And there are copies of a letter in there where each theater was going to be integrated at a certain time. And I tell you how bad it was. At the Arcadia Theater, they had a sign on the 5th Street side, a big sign, says, "Black colored entrance to the theater." You had to go up the steps to the balcony. Mm-hmm. And where they sold popcorn and stuff downstairs, in the entrance there, you had to go down the steps, come out and get your popcorn and go back upstairs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some people used to say, well, that's the best seat, you know. Well, it was, but it was just a matter of the white being separated from the black.
Now, what year did you start the Nonpartisan League?
I don't know.
Soon
probably
after you arrived.
I imagine it was probably 63 somewhere, and it wasn't too long.
Okay.
It was not too long.
And how did you work with the local NAACP? How did they feel about the organization?
There may have been some feelings, but it was not obvious if it was, you know, yeah. Uh-huh. And some people, a few of those people belonged to both of them, mm-hmm. both organizations, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. There was no conflict at that time.
Okay.
The only thing that bothered me was after we did so many things, we just decided to let the Nonpartisan League go and let the NAACP, since it had parent groups and everything, mm-hmm. be the organization. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Since it had parent groups, you mean at the
NAACP,
state and the
like a state
level.
And national, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So there is no Nonpartisan League.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how long did the league actually operate?
I'll say probably about 6 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
We integrated restaurants and picture shows, just about everything in Paducah. You could go anywhere you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand that there were individuals or a group from here in Paducah that went to Selma when the boycott for the march and whatnot there. Do you have any recollection of that? I've been told that by one person. Another person told me they really weren't aware of that.
Yeah, I was very young and so on, but Martin Luther King and I met the first time in 1956 mm-hmm. in Denver, Colorado at the National Baptist Convention, USA Incorporated. Mm-hmm. I knew his father. I'm probably 2 years older than Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King and I stayed in the, I believe it was Delaware Hotel, something like that, in Denver, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And they were adjoining rooms. Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, he was supposed to be the guest speaker at the National Baptist Convention, and J.H. Jackson was the president for a number of years. But J.H. Jackson was somewhat fearful of Martin Luther King because he was just on the rise, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was a conflict when he was supposed to speak. And so that, I was a young fellow too, so that kind of brought us together, you know. And it was just great.
Did he ever speak at that convention?
Yes, ma'am. He spoke at the convention. And probably about 3 or 4 years after that is when the convention split and the progressive organization mm-hmm. came into being. Gardner Taylor was the first president of the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. But Martin Luther King and J.H. Jackson's attitude toward him with the National Baptist Convention had a big bearing on the split of that convention. Mm-hmm. In fact, J.H. Jackson pastored the largest black church in America at that time. It was the Olivet Baptist Church in Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Olivet,
yes.
B-E-T.
Right. Okay. And that church was on South Parkway and I believe 31st Street. Mm-hmm. And I think they changed South Parkway to Martin Luther King Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And J.H. Jackson changed the address of the church to the other streets. He didn't want to get any mail from mm-hmm. on Martin Luther King Boulevard. Yeah.
That must have been years
later. Oh, it was.
Later and whatnot, yes. But still, it shows that he hadn't gotten over
it. No, he hadn't gotten over it. No, he had not gone over. Yeah, that's right.
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was there any involvement in Paducah? Or any members? Or
no. Yeah. Louisville is probably the closest place. Reverend Charles Kirby, who was a friend of mine and married a lady out of this, her people came out of this church. Betty Kaiser was her name.
And is Reverend Kirby still living?
He's pastoring Southern Star Baptist Church in Louisville. My daughter is one of the musicians there at that church. Okay. She's a minister of music. And Reverend Kirby's one of them that was inducted into this
okay.
the same time I was.
Okay.
Yes.
To the Hall of Fame?
Right. We're about the same age, yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
In 1964 in Frankfort, there was a rally in support of the public accommodations bill that was in the legislature, and it was the only statewide rally that was held.
Ike and Tina Turner was there at that rally. I was there.
Ike and
Tina Turner was guest for that.
And you?
I was there.
Okay. Did a group go from Paducah?
A busload from Paducah went. Yes, a busload from Paducah went.
Did you go under the sponsorship of the partisan league, nonpartisan league, or the NAACP, or was it just individuals?
I think it was just a group. I can't remember. I don't remember. I don't remember what name we went under or anything like that yet. Mm-hmm. But we were there.
Okay.
Yes.
And I believe Martin Luther King Jr. was there.
Yes. Yes.
Jackie Robinson.
Yes.
Peter Paul and
Mary. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Right. What do you remember about that day?
I remember so many people. That was one of the biggest rallies that I had possibly been to at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the March on Frankfort, that's what they called it, yes.
Right.
Uh-huh. I remember it very well.
What was the weather like that day?
The weather was nice. I can't remember any bad weather.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember any bad weather.
Okay. Was it cold? Because it was...
I don't think it was cold. I think it was probably chilly or something,
right.
But I don't believe it was cold. I can't remember what month it was held.
I think it was March.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about that.
Yes.
Either, so.
Mm-hmm. But it was cool. I remember that. Yes. It was not a summer sleeve, right. Short sleeve weather. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have any hopes for the day?
Yeah, I felt like that Kentucky was on the move, making progress.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I think that was one indication by the reception that that large group had at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought we was on the move. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you ever belong to the NAACP here in Kentucky?
I'm a lifetime member, and I received one of the highest awards right there. It's on the wall there.
Okay.
That's the reason I was telling you, there's so much history on this wall here.
There,
yeah.
Well, there certainly is. So you're a member of the local chapter, and that makes you a member of state and
yes.
the national.
Yes.
Well.
I have a $500 membership, which is a lifetime membership.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And have you played a leadership role within the NAACP?
Just a member and supporting activities and stuff that they've done. I've never held to office.
Okay.
Well, I did too. One time I held the church members, church committee. I think I served on that one time as chairman for it.
Okay.
Yes. That's about the limit of it. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have a story about attending a KKK meeting in Paducah. Reverend Harvey, I was just asking you to tell me about the KKK meeting here in Paducah that you attended.
Yes, I had come out of office in 1974, and in 1975, the Klan received a permit from Dolly McNutt. And
Dolly McNutt.
Dolly McNutt, who became mayor and also became a state representative later on.
Is that a woman?
A woman. Dolly? She was the first woman to be elected to the Paducah City Commission. I was the first black person and preacher to be elected to a public office. Mm-hmm. From Henderson to Guthrie, from Owensboro, Kentucky, to Hickman, Kentucky. And so anyway, these people asked for a permit, and after receiving a permit, well, they had basically received the permit by saying that the committee would be, I mean, their thing that they were going to have there was, program was going to be public. It had to be public for the city to give them a permit, whether it was they're going to charge or whether it would be free. And so they agreed that it would be public, but after Friday, after the city hall closed, they stated that there would be no niggers permitted to come to that meeting.
They stated that how?
Over the news media at that time, that there would be no niggers permitted to that meeting.
And did the Paducah Sun report that?
I don't remember. I don't have any recollection of it.
Did the radio report that? Or?
I don't remember it being reported. But anyway, I went back and called Dolly McNutt. I called Tommy Lambert. I called Henry Perrier. And I believe it was John Hornsby at that time was the other commissioner. And I asked them if they would revoke that permit. And they were so frightened. They said, Reverend, I just don't believe we want to do that because they'll have to burn crosses in our yard, and they'll tell them what they're like. They were fearful, you know. I just said, well, okay, if you won't revoke the permit, I will make it public. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't know what I meant, and I didn't go into any details. So on Sunday morning, when I finished preaching, I said, how would you all like to go to the Klan rally with me? And so they just laughed. They didn't take it seriously, you know. So when I left church, I went straight to what was a J.C. Civic Center at that time. Now it's the Robert Cherry Center.
And you went alone?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I went alone. And when I got to the J.C. Civic Center, there was a man there that went in with me. His name was Preston Kennedy. He still lives in Reedland. He's probably old man, probably 88 years old, something like that.
Where does he live?
Somewhere in Reedland.
Spell that for me.
Reedland, R-E-I-D-L-A-N-D, Reedland, Kentucky. It's only just outskirts of Paducah. And he was there at that particular time, and he went in with me. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe I was really going to go in, but I did, and he went in with me.
And he was black also?
No, he's white.
He's white. Okay.
He was the editor of the Paducah Sun at that time.
Oh, okay.
He was the editor of the Paducah Sun. And before we went in, there was an ambulance backed up there, and there was two black men, young men, that they were put in the ambulance, and the Klan had beat them up. For some reason, I don't know whether they were trying to enter or what, but then they beat them up and they were going. And everybody was so surprised that I was still going to go in. I went in. Everybody was robed. I thought it was the most pathetic thing when I got inside and I seen Caucasian women in here with small children running around playing their thing, you know. But all the men were robed. I didn't see any female that I knew at that particular time.
What would you estimate the size of the...
Probably 175, between 175 and 200 people. Okay. Yes, it was full. Yeah, it was full. And David Duke was the Grand Dragon at that particular time. I've got pictures of him right behind you there. David Duke was the Grand Dragon, and I sat probably about 15 feet in front of him. And when he opened his meeting, he said, "I'm glad that there's no damn niggers here in this meeting." Yeah. And I looked at Preston, and Preston looked at me at that particular time. I sat there till they had an interview, intermission. Mm-hmm. After the intermission, I decided to leave, and I left at that particular time. We heard a lot of noise outside, and to my surprise, the members of my church had found out about it. And there's pictures there of Jim Burr, who was one of the young deacons that was there outside, and oh gosh, there was three times as many people outside as there was inside. I know that there's 500 out there, at least outside, black and white. And most of these people at that time, I believe, were anti-Klan for Paducah, you know, but there was a few sympathizers too with them, I'm sure. And I was just shocked when I got out and seen all those people, you know, yeah. But it was quite an experience. But my reason was, for going there was not just to be braggadocious or anything like that, but I went there because I wanted to make it public, because these people would not revoke that permit. Mm-hmm. That was my reason for going.
And they were meeting in a public facility.
Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why I did. And I look back now at the whole incident, it makes me sort of shake, you know, mm-hmm. things that could happen. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. after that, the Klan drove past my house in robes. They didn't want me to know who they were, in robes. And where I live is dead end into Noble Park, and they drive down and turn around and come back out. And so, you know, I had all kinds of calls, but there was never any incident as such, you know, other than just showing themselves and calling, you know.
Did they say anything when they called?
Oh yes, they would cuss me and say they were going to kill me and this and that and all that kind of stuff, you know. Yeah. One Sunday morning after that, they called the church, Harrison Street Baptist Church, and said that they were going to come over and blow the church up, this and that and everything like that. And I remember them blocking off churches on Harrison Street between 11th and 12th, and the city blocked off 11th Street and blocked off 12th Street so no cars could come through there unless it was some membership going to the parking lot, because there's somebody there, you know, mm-hmm. and so on, you know. But there was nobody ever showed up. Nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then later, I've got two or three articles here. There's one right there. It says W.G. Harvey helped city. That's an article by the Paducah Sun. And they said that the Klan never got a foothold here because I embarrassed them so much by my presence at their meeting. Mm-hmm. And then later, the other sign there is when David Duke ran for governor of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And he claimed to be a born-again Christian. They interviewed me at that time, and that's when they brought it back and put David Duke's picture there and my picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the only two stories about the Klan at all in my involvement.
Did that story get picked up on the AP, or it just got local press?
Local press, that's all. Nobody else knew except somebody that some relative or something told him or something, you know, or somebody mouth to mouth, but it was never on any media that I know of. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Other than the Paducah song.
Yes. Yes.
Don't you think that's a little strange in this day and age? That.
Well, at that time, I really, after my experience with Kentucky Humanities and KET, after they had this information and they did nothing about it, I felt like, first I felt like that Paducah did not want the country to know that they had a black man here, mm-hmm. that was courageous enough to go to a Klan rally and come out not hurt. Mm-hmm. Or anything, you know. I don't think Paducah wanted that to be known out of Paducah. Mm-hmm. And then after Kentucky Humanities didn't do anything about it, mm-hmm. and after KET didn't do anything, after receiving all this documentation, mm-hmm. I felt like it maybe Kentucky felt that way. I couldn't help but feel that way at that time, you know, yeah. And Dr. Robinson, who here, Dr. Robinson is one of the great historians here, you know.
Right. He wrote the history of
Right.
Paducah.
And the first time he wrote his book, he talked about places being integrated and me being an activist and so on, but just a very little. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any knowledge of him ever enlarging mm-hmm. on this here. And I called him and told him that I had sent this information to Kentucky Humanities mm-hmm. and KET. Because he was on one of those boards. And the way he talked, like, well, I'm just a member and I don't have anything to do with it, Reverend. I can't help you, or so on. But, so he never did.
I guess I'm not so surprised about Kentucky Humanities and KET because of the nature of their programs.
Yes.
But it does surprise me that the Paducah Sun did not share that with the Associated Press.
Yes. I don't know why. I don't know why. You can look at the articles, and it will tell you.
If I would like to do that.
There they are behind you. If the Associated Press had it, you know, and it never did say. Wherever the Associated Press has an article, they'll tell you, you know, Associated Press, you know, yes.
Let me ask you a few questions, please, about that event. You said there was not a Klan chapter here in Paducah, so the people who came to this rally were...
I think they came from different places. Now, they did have some kind of organization, I think, up around Benton and somewhere up in Marshall County, something like that, because the spokesman at that time that made the arrangements, I can't remember the name now, he was from Calvert City or Benton or somewhere up in there. Mm-hmm. I did know his name one time, but I forgot his name later. He's the one that made the arrangements, yes. And like the Grand Dragon from Louisiana, and there's people come from Indiana, Ohio, the other places, you know, they came here for this particular rally, mm-hmm. just like a convention meet somewhere. People come from other areas, you know, yeah. And that's the way that was.
But then the follow-up to you of the phone calls and driving by your house, that probably, don't you think, was done by local people locally?
Yes, or? Yes. There was a small house on 13th Street, North 13th Street. And there was a young man, I can't remember the name, this was several years after that, a young man that established some kind of department of the Klan there. And he was trying to get some activity started among young whites. And Prince Hatchett was the president of the NAACP. Prince Hatchett was the pastor of Washington Street Baptist Church at that time. And he lived over on the Cleed in the parsonage over there. And the Klan, some Klan members or sympathizers came by and threw some kind of Molly cocktail bomb or something like that on this and burnt the garage attached to the house, just a little bit of something, not too much about it. And then later on, Tobacco and Firearms found out about the place on 13th Street. And they raided it, broke it up, and they found a list of people that they were supposed to shoot or assassinate in that building. And they say I was the second person on the list. Mm-hmm. Prince Hatchett was the first person on the list, but that was only because of being the president of the NAACP, because nothing really constructive was being done at that time by the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, my name was second on the list, they said.
Do you remember any other names that you heard were on the list?
No, I don't remember any other names, but I just heard that I was the second person on the list. Mm-hmm. The young man that lived there and operated this office, that was a trial, and I think they give him 4 or 5 years or something like that, unless he got out earlier. I never heard from him anymore. Can't remember the name. Yeah. So it just sort of faded out, you know, yeah. But I remember the day that the house was raided and everything by tobacco and firearms at that time, yeah. A fellow by the name of Mickey Sullivan, who's dead now, Caucasian fine young man, was head of the firearms, tobacco and firearms at that time here. His wife worked for Carol Hubbard. She was his main secretary at that particular time. Yeah.
At the day of the rally that you attended, I know this is a long time back to think mm-hmm. about this, but do you remember the content of any of the talks or the speakers that you heard that day?
The only thing I can remember was that they were people that just felt like the black man was, blacks and Jews were not even considered or not important at all. They were just for the white race. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were the white race. They were anti-everything that was not white. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did they talk about any actions or programs or activities that they wanted to bring about?
I don't remember that. I don't remember that at all. I can't remember that. Anything that I could actually document. Yeah. Yes, I don't remember that. But all I remember is that they were just like a white citizens council. They mm-hmm. thought that nobody else was important, and that blacks were coming in and taking over and so on, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there any evidence of a white citizens council in Paducah?
No, not that I know of.
Okay, so the Klan has been there.
Right, that was the main one that's ever been here. I know of, yeah.
You must have been a little nervous, I guess, to be in there with all that.
I tell you what, believe it or not, but I can't believe I was as courageous and as fearless mm-hmm. as I was. But I prayed over it, and I am a Christian, and I felt like that the Lord created all people equal, and He don't make any difference in people. Everybody should have the same opportunities to live where they can afford and be a first-class citizen, you know. Mm-hmm. I felt like that I had those God-given rights, and I didn't care what happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't care what happened. I felt like everything would be all right, mm-hmm. and that's the reason why I went.
Were there any police in the
not inside. Not inside. No. If there's any police were there, outside. Yeah, no police inside, yeah.
How did your family feel about you going?
Oh, they were fearless. I mean, they're fearful for me, yeah. Fearful, very, very fearful for me, yes. My mother, gosh, she was really upset. My wife, and I can't remember the attitude of the children at that time. They were small.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you had been a city commissioner, I believe,
Yes, ma'am.
Correct? Okay.
City commissioner and mayor pro tem.
Okay. Tell me about your move to become a city commissioner.
Well, there had been a number of men. Ivo Boyd, a man by the name of Ivo Boyd, was one. He had ran 3 or 4 times. And a man by the name of Frank Brown.
These are black men?
Yes.
Okay.
That's two that had ran for office. And they had a lot of political rallies and things like that, you know, but nobody could ever get elected. And the reason why that nobody could ever get elected was because they only campaigned in black neighborhoods, and there was not enough black people to elect them.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I couldn't figure out when I came here, why anybody would campaign just in black neighborhoods when it was a citywide election. There was no wards, no districts.
Mm-hmm.
So you were going to be a commissioner if elected by all the people in Paducah. And so the first thing I did.
Tell me what period we're talking about here. What
1968.
I started the campaigning, and I said, the first thing I'm going to do we had 24 districts at that time, 24 precincts at that time. I said, I'm going to cover all of them. I'm not just going to campaign where black people are. So I went to Buckland Lane, which was one of the, probably the most famous Caucasian place at that particular time, the homes and everything, you know. I went straight to Buckland Lane.
Buckner
Lane, yes. Buckner. And there was a huge house. I can't remember the name of the people or anything at all, but it was wealthy people. I went there and knocked on the front door. A black woman came to the door. And she said, "What you want?" And I said, "I want to talk to the man of the house or the lady of the house. I'm campaigning for commissioner." She said, "You go around to the back door." I went around to the back door. And she brought the lady to the back door. She was standing there behind her with her, you know. The lady opened the door and asked me who I was, what I wanted, anything. I told her, "I'm Reverend W.G. Harvey, the pastor of Harrison Street Baptist Church. I'm running for city commissioner. And I'd just like to let her know a little about my platform and so on, you know." She said, "Come right on in, Reverend." I went on in the house. And she carried me right on up to the den. We sat there and got acquainted and talked, you know. And she said, "You're the first black person that ever came and asked me to vote for them." And I said, "Well, I probably am aware of that. I heard that most of them campaigned in black neighborhoods, you know." And she was just as nice as could be. And she called this black woman and told her, said, "Bring us some coffee." I can't remember. I wish I could think of her name. I've tried 1,000 times to think of it. "Bring us some coffee." And boy, she rolled her eyes at me, looked all funny, and she went and got coffee and brought it in there, you know. And I drank coffee, and I didn't even want coffee, but I drank coffee. And we sat there and talked probably a half an hour. And when I got ready to go, I remember distinctly, she called that lady and said, "You let him out the front door. And if he ever comes here again, don't you never take him to the back door." I remember that just as plain. I told you, I don't know how many times. I'm so sorry, I can't think of her name. And so I was so well accepted in so many places. All right, so I missed this election by less than 10 votes. I think it was between 4 and 7 votes. Mm-hmm. I missed being elected. And a white man by the name of Bill Fellows, or William Fellows,
F-E-L-L-O-W-S.
Yes, was the one that just barely beat me. He was the most outgoing, friendliest fellow you ever saw in your life when he talked to me. And I found out that he was going, when he was campaigning in white neighborhoods, he would tell them, "If you elect that nigger, we're going to really be in serious trouble. We cannot afford to elect a black man." So he only beat me by that narrow margin after indoctrinating Caucasian people and all that. All right. I had told my church at that time, before the election, I said, "I'm going to be the next commissioner. I'm going to be the first black commissioner to be elected. I can tell by the attitudes of the people that I campaigned with in white communities." And so after the election, Bill Fellows got seriously sick. This was before the swearing in and everything. So they sent Bill Fellows to the University of Kentucky Hospital. They had an exploratory operation. Bill Fellows died at UK. And when Bill Fellows died at UK, they hadn't sworn the commissioners in or anything at that particular time. Or he didn't get sworn. And I think they had one swore the others in. Couldn't, but he was up there maybe a week or so. And so there was a number of people that went to City Hall. Robert Cherry was the mayor at that particular time. Large number of black and white people that went to City Hall. And they said, "We believe that you ought to appoint Reverend W.G. Harvey, because he was the next man in line for votes, and Bill Fellows just barely beat him." At that time, Robert Cherry was just a little reluctant to do this. The law is that the mayor has to make the appointment and the city commission has to ratify it. I think it's the same law that is used when people are appointed to a board. The mayor makes appointment and the city commission is ratified. So anyway, overwhelmingly, this was done, and reluctantly, Bob Cherry made the appointment and it was ratified. And so after so many days, there has to be a runoff election. I don't remember what it was, 90 days or what, 3 months, I think. So a man by the name of James Lynn, a white man.
L-Y-N-N.
Yes, worked for an insurance company here. The insurance company was located at 12th and Broadway. I haven't seen him, I don't know if he's even alive yet or not. He filed to run against me, the only person that filed against me. Bob Cherry, who thought I was going to be all right after a while, those 90 days after working with me, he enjoyed me. We become the very best of friends with friends until he died here just a few years ago. They begged him to not run against me so I would automatically have that seat. He said, no, I'm going to run against a nigger anyway. He ran. And when he ran, I beat him 3-1. So that was really my first election. The first 90 days, it was appointment. Yeah.
Tell me what you remember about your first meeting with the commission.
In the commission? Mm-hmm. Oh, it was exciting. A lot of people came and filled the hall to see me. Mm-hmm. And then Bob Cherry was the president of some nationwide florist organization. Mm-hmm. And Bob Cherry had to go abroad somewhere, Italy or somewhere. And so I served as mayor pro tem. Mm-hmm. Now this was after my second election.
Right. But your first meeting, I mean, here you are, the first black member of the commission ever.
Yes. It was exciting. It was exciting. And it seemed like the people were very enthusiastic about it and so on, you know. And the meetings were better attended, I guess, to see how I was going to function or how I was accepted or something, you know. Yeah, exciting. The commission term runs for 2 years. Mm-hmm. The next term is when I became mayor pro tem because I received more votes than anybody. And Dolly McNutt was the first woman to be elected to the city commission. Mm-hmm. So we were great friends.
This would have been 1970,
something like that. Yeah, because I came out in 74. I did 3 2-year terms. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Why did you come out?
Well, there's just a lot of things happening. I'll just let you see this.
And were there any other black commissioners at that point in time?
At this particular time, a man ran against me by the name of Frank Brown. Mm-hmm. And Robert Cherry and I were very good friends, but I was always my own man, and Bob knew this. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things were happening, but there was some jealousy in the black community. Mm-hmm. And you can see all those important people there. I mean, that is the crust of the black community that supported a man by the name of Joe Bush, who ran for city commissioner, and Frank Brown, who is alive yet. Frank and I are friends now. But I went through a whole lot of stuff with the black community. And when the election was over, the two of them only had 1,300 votes. Mm-hmm. And I had 4,900 votes. And as I said, a lot of those were white votes. Mm-hmm. And they believed in me and they supported me. And there are other articles in this book here that tells you this.
Did you decide not to run again in part because of the tensions within the black community?
Or? It had its bearing, but not really. The 6 years that I spent on the commission, I felt like that there were some things I possibly was not doing at church, my church work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some things that I was probably not doing with my children at that age. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason why I didn't run anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. This had its bearing. It hurt me to see the black people have the attitude that they had, you know. But they wanted me to do special things for black people. And I stood on my philosophy that I am a city commissioner of Paducah, Kentucky. I don't represent a ward. And I was called the people's commissioner. And I stuck by my philosophy. Yeah.
What do you consider your biggest accomplishments in those 6 years as a commissioner?
Well, I was able to, just because of the office, I was able to get a lot of jobs for black people. Mm-hmm. I was able to hire a lot of black people, get a lot of black people hired for the city. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was no black people in City Hall. Well, I did that before. When I was actively involved nonpartisanly, got the first black person to work in City Hall other than janitors. She worked in the clerical department, in the finance department there. But I got a lot of jobs. I got a lot of jobs for people.
I heard of from Gladman
Humbles.
Mm-hmm. That you were helpful to him.
Yes.
In becoming the first black firefighter.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And also fire assistant fire chief. Mm-hmm. And my son is assistant fire chief now, and I had nothing to do with it. Maybe the name helped. I did not do anything particularly to say, please do this for him, and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs. And at one time, the city, under Bill Murphy, wanted to sell the refuge department. Well, more black men working for the refuge department than there was any other place in town at that time. And we didn't want that to happen. We thought we still had better service on it than selling it to be. And at that time, I was connected here. In fact, I had literature, books that I got from New York and Washington, D.C., that verified it, that, you know. And so Bill and that commission wanted to sell this mayors we ever had to people in general. He came here working for the Chamber of Commerce as director. That's how he came to Paducah. And so I said, well, we'll see about getting them in. So anyway, I organized a group, and I had a bunch of city workers, and I had wealthy people, Caucasians, that joined me. They didn't want to see the BFI come and take it over and everything. And so we really put an organization together. And after the signatures came in, I think I had 4,800 signatures that was needed to put on the referendum. And I have that in here, the suit and everything. And I hired Jim Owens, who's an attorney here, and Bill Graves, who's a appeals judge. Mm-hmm. William Bill Graves, yes, and they handled the case, and we won. When the election was over, we beat them 3-1 in votes, and they couldn't sell it until the city owns it today. Mm-hmm. City owns it today.
And saved the jobs.
Yes.
For the city.
Yes. Okay. So me being there, it opened a lot of doors, and as of now, I probably get an average of 20. I get from 20 to sometimes 27 calls a day asking me to help them with this or that, or so on. Mm-hmm. If it's either something that's connected with my ministry, like come and pray for me, I'm going to have an operation, mm-hmm. or at the hospital, or either a nursing home call, or somebody wants to help to try to get in a nursing home, or somebody just wants some information how to do something that they don't have the knowledge and know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I will say that 5% of those calls are from Caucasians. Mm-hmm. Believe in me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the commission is what gave me, that was my launching pad. Yeah. And then I had a broadcast, a radio broadcast for 15 years, and I had a telecast. In fact, we had the first black operated and owned cable station in America, the second one, Clay Evans Fellowship Baptist Church in Chicago probably had the first. Yeah, and so that broadcast went from Douglas Communication in Jackson, Tennessee, all down through West Tennessee and down through part of Mississippi. And then the tape was sent to North Chicago,
And this was to broadcast your church service?
Church service. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. all up in there, and Toledo, Ohio. So this gave me a lot of latitude, you know, for people knowing who I am. So my work, really, when I talk about calls and so on, it's not just people in Paducah. I mean, I've had calls, people I've helped from Hopkinsville, from Madisonville, from Cadiz, from Murray, from Hickman, from Mayfield. I've even had people that were connected with NAACP to call me, another organization where there's problems, and I've contributed to it. Okay. And
recently, the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights had its 40th anniversary celebration, and you were nominated and selected as one of 21 individuals for their Civil Rights Hall of Fame. A big honor.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you tell me, how do you feel about that?
It's something that really I never anticipated. Mm-hmm. I do not have all of this on these walls to be braggadocious, mm-hmm. but Black history has been so suppressed, pushed mm-hmm. under the rug, and so on, you know. And so I've got this here for the young people at this church and other people that happen to come. They can just see that some of the things that we enjoy today came through sweat, blood, and tears. Mm-hmm. A lot of hard work. I don't do this as a person that's bragging, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for the readers of the transcript, we're in Reverend Harvey's office at the church, and the walls are just covered with news articles and photographs and historical information.
The lady that came from the Sun to do this interview after, I was on the 20th of July, 2 days after I was inducted, she counted everything, and she said she counted 163, which was in the news article. Have you seen the news article?
No,
I'll save one for you. Okay. All right, okay. And when I came back here, all of this here has to do with my induction, that whole wall there. Has to do with my induction. The pictures that were taken by the membership that was there, uh-huh. and other clippings from the paper. Mm-hmm. So to add it to this will be the 133rd session of the Grand Lodge of Kentucky, the Prince Hall affiliated, that was held in Louisville at the God House the last week of July, mm-hmm. when they accepted this induction. And I don't know what all they're going to have on it, but they're sending a big plaque.
But you don't have any more room on your walls or anything else here. Need another room,
yes,
I think.
Yes, so. I just wanted to just really keep it for young people to know, you know, where we come from.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me before we started the tape that a group of you went to Louisville for
yes, ma'am.
The award. Were these people from your church?
All members of the church. All members of the church. My chairman, Tony Mackey, and Vince Duncan, one of our male workers and deacons, works with young people, and the rest of them were ladies. And they went, and they were just excited. In fact, they've done most of this here. They're going to change the heading up there. Mm-hmm. We have somebody to come and professionally mm-hmm. Put a heading up there for it. But they're just happy about it. You know, the church is happy about it.
That's
yes.
Great.
I'm going to be celebrating my 38th anniversary on the 8th of October as a pastor in Paducah, 38 years, mm-hmm. yeah. And they're excited about that, and they're going to do a lot of special things that I don't even know anything about.
Do you have any plans to retire?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
No, ma'am. In fact, I don't really have a retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a sad commentary, but I want to go in history since we're talking about it. I pastored Harrison Street Baptist Church for 23 years and 10 months. And after a lot of dissension, a lot of problems, I left there. And we organized this church because 89 people talked to me about, let's organize another church, you know. I had the first Black retirement plan through Prudential Insurance, a good one, that would have given me a good retirement beside my Social Security.
You had that with the other church.
With the other church, and it was transferable. But about 2 months after this church had been organized, I went to Prudential to attempt to transfer it. And they told me that the officers of that church had already taken it out and cashed it in. They probably wouldn't have gotten over about $3,000 out of it. And I think, to my best recollection, what recollection was, I could have drawn probably about $14,000 to $15,000 when I got 65, and could have drawn about $700 a month. So that would have made me a good retirement. Yes.
But here you were starting a whole new church.
Whole new thing,
that's
right.
Own, and so
yes.
You didn't.
So I have no retirement.
You didn't have the income at that point,
right.
Actually.
Right. And I got really excited when. After I was inducted into the Human Rights, Civil Rights Hall of Fame, people in the congregation, I mean, in the audience of just talking, you know, some of them said, you know, said, you're going to be real famous. I said, I'll tell you what, said, I bet you that some people are going to be calling you and wanting you to do a commercial. I said, oh, that would be great because I don't have any retirement. And
right.
I was in there's a big picture around the corner here. I was in a movie. I was in a movie, In Country. It's still available.
Right.
In Country, yes.
That's the title of a novel by Bobby Ann Mason, who's an author here.
All right, okay.
Okay,
and Bruce Willis was in that, one of the main stars, and Emily Lloyd from England came here. She was in that, and I was in the movie. Now, not a real big part, but I was in it, you know.
And how did that come about?
Well, I'll tell you what. I applied for it, and I missed it. My wife applied for it. They were asking for people to come, you know, and my wife missed it.
Now, what do you mean when you say you missed it?
Was not accepted to participate.
Okay.
Yes, okay. So I happened to be downtown one day, and this was the last week that they were doing shots and everything, you know, and I run into Ralph Abernathy's daughter. I knew Ralph Abernathy. I knew Martin Luther King. I was in several meetings with them and Jesse Jackson. In fact, I spoke at SIU when Jesse Jackson ran for president, and there was over 6,000 people at SIU when I spoke
there.
Southern Illinois University. Yeah,
okay.
Right. And so I knew all of them, and I knew Abernathy real well. And his daughter knew me. And I was shocked. She said, Marvin, said, how come you haven't come down the plot? I said, I did, but I missed it. She said, I'll tell you what, I'm working there. She had a high position in making that movie. She said, you come down there such and such a time, talk to me, and I'll introduce you to these other people, and you will be in this movie. I want you in there. I went down there the next day. She told me what to bring. She was so sure I was going to be in, what to bring and everything. You know, I did, and I ended up in the movie. There's a picture there of me standing between Bruce Lloyd and Bruce Willis and Emily Lloyd. Mm-hmm. Small picture there, and then there's a big plaque around there showing the rest of it, all the characters and everything. Yeah.
I actually just looked at that on video not too long ago.
You did?
I have to go back now that I know you and see if I see you there.
I mean, it shows me a couple of times in there, and it shows the old blue Seville that I had with a black top on. It's in there and everything.
Well, let me ask you a question about race relations overall in Paducah, because you had the advantage of having lived elsewhere before you came to Paducah.
Yes.
And I wonder how you would evaluate race relations, say, in the 60s when you arrived here with other communities that you had been involved in, or Louisville. You know, were things moving along in the whole struggle for civil rights here? Were they the same as they were in other places? Were they different?
As I said, we solved a lot of problems in Evansville, Indiana, before I left there. The first 6 years I was there. So when I come here, we had to start all over again. There was no accommodations at motels, hotels, and restaurants, and so on. The school system, that's the biggest problem we have here now. this is full of lawsuits that I filed with Kentucky. Dr. Cody.
Cody,
yeah, when he was there as a head. I filed with him, and I filed with the federal government, Board of Education, so on, you know, against school problems. And we still have a lot of school problems. We don't have enough black teachers, and we have, I'll say the enrollment at Tillman High School is probably 48% black. And you probably have about between 7 and 10% black teachers. And the same thing is happening with the state as it relates to faculty at West Kentucky Technical College, which used to be West Kentucky Vocational School, which was probably 90% black as it relates to teachers and also students. And so I just was in a meeting yesterday morning at 7:30 at breakfast at West Kentucky Vocational School. West Kentucky Vocational School, most all the janitors, teachers, I doubt whether they have over 3 or 4 teachers there at West Kentucky Vocational Technical School. And the enrollment, they announced yesterday morning that the enrollment was down to about 7% black. Of course, it is a part now of Paducah Community College, you know. That was the purpose of moving it out there. I know about the political things that took it out there from where it was. And I knew what was going to happen, too. And so it's just gone now. But this meeting was to try to recruit blacks. Now, I don't know whether they're waking up and see they got to do something different. So we told them this the morning, said, not only do you need to recruit blacks, but you need black instructors. Because it's not going to be attracting. It's not going to be easy to recruit blacks, and you have no black faculty at all, you know.
And you were meeting with school officials? Is that who you were?
We were meeting with the instructor and part of the faculty of West Kentucky Technical College.
Let me back up a minute. You just mentioned that the technical college was now part of the community college.
Yes.
When that happened, what were their advantages or disadvantages for that kind of consolidation to the black community?
It was not an advantage to the black community, in my opinion.
Okay.
Because we don't have enough people, enough students that are going. Mm-hmm. We only have just a few students.
Whereas before?
Well, before it was probably 90%. Probably 90%. And we had people coming from everywhere. There wasn't any problem with recruiting because it was known all across the country. In fact, West Kentucky Vocational School was the third largest black facility in America. Even in the Allens, Bahamas, places like that, we had some people to come to West Kentucky Vocational School. It was that kind of quality school. Yeah. And so now, we don't even have enough participation from the people that are here.
Why do you think that is?
Because they have no black instructors to mount anything at all. Calvin Cole is an instructor in tailoring. He lives just 3 doors from me. He's my neighbor. And we may have 1 or 2 more. That's it. That's it.
But with the merger, what happened to the black instructors?
They did away with them as they retired, never replaced them. That's the same thing was done here with Lincoln High School and Tillman High School. Some that they did move, they either made them truant officers or librarians or something like that, you know. When they retired, they never got replaced. Yes, they never got replaced.
Of course, one of the things that we read about in the press is that there's a shortage of black teachers everywhere in this country.
There is a possibility that there are, yes.
And that that teacher or black graduates of colleges now have more job opportunities than they did at one point when teaching was.
Yes.
How do you respond to that?
Well, I think here in Paducah, a lot of the problem that they have here is with the Board of Education, the local Board of Education. I don't believe they've done everything that they could have done. One of the biggest fights that we've had here is with Dr. Ramage, There is a article right there on the board where Dr. Ram...
School superintendent.
Is a school superintendent, yes. There was really a black woman that should have had the job. Her name was Dr. Jean Kearney. She was the assistant superintendent. And Dr. Ramage came in over her because he was accepted by the board. And she had better qualifications, 2-1, than Dr. Ramage had, but they hired him. And the board has supported him in everything that he has done. And I don't believe he has sincerely really tried to do any better as it relates to hiring black teachers. And he broke every kind of law trying to hold on to certain things that he wanted to do. There's an article there where Dr. Cody and them fined the district $62,000. I'm the one that filed a complaint. $62,000, and it's got about six laws there that he broke trying to just have his own way and hold on to a man that he wanted to be principal of Cooper Whiteside. His name was William Cartwright. Dr. Cody had a lady, Dr. Ramage had a lady that was the assistant principal of Cooper Whiteside. She had all kinds of degrees, certifications for principalship, and William Cartwright had no certification at all. But Dr. Ramage said he's going to be principal here. And the board supported him. Only one person, a black lady by the name of Joyce Nelson at that time, her name is Joyce Henderson now, was the only one that stood against it. And so I filed a complaint with the Kentucky Board of Education. I filed it with the federal government, and then they backed off later because it was filed within the state, which makes sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the state fined the district $60,000 for all the laws that he broke. In fact, Dr. Ramage made Bill Cartwright the principal. They called it head teacher. That's what it was, head teacher, but served in the same capacity as a principal. And I looked up the law, and the law said that you could do this, but it was where there was, I think, four or five classrooms or something like that, and just a small amount of people, you could use a head teacher. But why would you have a head teacher to run a school when you've got an assistant principal that has all of the qualifications and more to be the principal and not put her there because she's black? All right. So this girl left there and went to Dayton, Ohio, and she is the principal of a large school and has four other people working under her as aides to the principal.
Tell me about the racial makeup of the local school board at this point in time.
They have two blacks.
Out of how many?
Out of five people, with the chairman.
Okay.
Yes, four board members and the chairman. Mm-hmm. The chairman is Dr. Gwynn.
Okay. It sounds like you're still an active.
They have four votes. They have four votes to do whatever they want to do. Joyce Nelson is the only one that will stand for what's right. Black know this. White people know this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's why Dr. Ramage is able to do anything he wants to do.
It sounds like you're still an activist.
I am. Very much an activist. I'm proud of it because I am an activist for what is right, regardless of race, creed, or color.
Right.
Yes, I'm for what is right. That's exactly right.
Is there anything else, Reverend Harvey, that we haven't talked about today that you think is important to include here?
Oh, I would just like to say that we still have problems. We have problems in employment. We have problems with municipal housing. And as far as accommodations and things like that, we don't have any problems. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have enough jobs. We have people that are qualified for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's the problem. That's an ongoing problem. That's an ongoing problem. And there's still racism in Paducah. Now this year, the 8th of August, it was sort of a mixed thing, multicultural.
That's your Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, I was glad to see that. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'll say we're making progress. We're making progress, but it's no utopia. Mm-hmm. It's no utopia. Okay. There is an undercurrent yet that does not want it to happen. Yeah, I'll just give you an example. I noticed it became very obvious to me a few years ago. We could have a interracial ministers meeting, and all pastors could be together in this meeting, you know, and we'd be having a real good time, you know. We'd be eating donuts and drinking coffee and so on, and just patting one another on the back and talking. Everything would be fine, you know. But if you would be somewhere at the mall or somewhere else, and some of those pastors that had big churches would see you, they'd duck off another way rather than meet you and talk to you and fellowship about them. But here last year, something happened, and now they are reaching out, trying to have a better relationship as it relates to congregations, going to other mixed congregations. Mm-hmm. They want to mix congregations, you know, so it's better, you know. They want to be interracial, you know. And I have a few, always. I've baptized, I guess, at least 25 Caucasians since I've been in Paducah, the 30 years I've been there. In fact, I've always said the Lord is interested in everybody. Mm-hmm. Out of one blood, God created all nations that dwell upon the face of the earth. That's been my philosophy.
What happened last year?
Last year, they began to have some interracial meetings at Southland, Don Young's church, at the Heartland Baptist Church, mm-hmm. Heartland, one of the largest in town here. And they began to bring in some people to try to make race relations better, you know. In fact, they brought several black national preachers here to preach, you know, to try to make race relations a little better, you know. And there was a number of black people that went to the meetings and so on, you know, yeah. So they're trying now. They're trying now. We have hope, you know, that things will get better, you know. People are just people. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.